This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with political science scholar John Ehrenberg about his new book, White Nationalism and the Republican Party, Toward Minority Rule in America.
This is the problem of what's the matter with Kansas. How do the Republicans get people to vote against their own interests? Listen in, and you'll figure out the answer to that question. We speak with the great investigative reporter, Lisa Graves. She has, for the last 10 years, been looking into the influence of dark money on recruiting and placing ultra-right-wing lawyers on our federal benches.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org. White supremacy has been a guiding principle of the United States since its birth. From the genocide of the Indians to the pernicious institution of slavery, racism has permeated every aspect of this nation. After the short-lived period of Reconstruction, Jim Crow followed, and it continues to animate race relations in the U.S. While the Civil Rights Movement led to the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, the Republican Party, and now the right-wing Supreme Court, have adopted policies to undermine the protections of the promise of racial equality. False claims that the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump and the ensuing attempted insurrection have shaken the institutions of democracy to their core. Trump rode racism and nativism to the presidency, making it the nucleus of his regime. After descending the escalator to announce his presidential campaign, Trump singled out Mexico, declaring, "They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists." One of his first acts as president was the creation of the Muslim ban, which married white supremacy with nativism. White nationalism didn't begin with Trump. Barry Goldwater, George Wallace, Richard Nixon, and Ronald Reagan planted the seeds for Trump to adopt white supremacy as the explicit centerpiece of his campaign and his presidency. Whether or not Trump runs for president in 2024, Trumpism is unfortunately alive and well in our political system. Political science scholar John Ehrenberg has just published a book titled White Nationalism and the Republican Party, Toward Minority Rule in America. In it, he explains how Trump weaponized the use of race, drawing on his Republican predecessors. We are fortunate to interview John today on Law and Disorder. John is Senior Professor Emeritus and former Chair of the Political Science Department at Long Island University in New York. He has devoted his life to research and writing about political ideologies and the history of political thought. John is the author of Civil Society, The Critical History of an Idea, Proudhon and His Age, and The Dictatorship of the Proletariat, Marxism's Theory of Socialist Democracy. Full disclosure, in the 1960s, John and I both participated in the Stanford University Honors Program called Social Thought and Institutions. John Ehrenberg, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, of course.
The South used to be Democratic. Now it's Republican. How did the GOP move from being racially conservative to implicitly white nationalist? What was Richard Nixon's Southern strategy?
Well, the South is key to this whole process, this historical process that really began with the Civil Rights Movement. And the Civil Rights Movement did kick the South from being a reliably conservative Democratic bastion into the GOP. What it did was it forced the National Democratic Party to make a choice. And This was a historical process that really had begun in 1876 when the South became a democratic preserve. But the civil rights movement compelled, against their wishes, by the way, compelled most national Democratic Party figures, particularly John F. Kennedy, to make a choice between a national presence on the civil rights scene and remaining in this backwater of the American South. And as the Democratic Party began to block with the national civil rights movement and black majority cities in the Northeast and Midwest, the solid South, which had been solidly Democratic, became solidly Republican. Nixon's Southern strategy recognized that and built upon the notion that a unified, monolithic, conservative, white Southern base would be critical to the Republican Party's electoral prospects moving forward, and he was absolutely correct. So the national configuration of the American electorate really became solidified with Nixon's conquest of the American South. Much of that was prepared by George Wallace, and I tell that story in the book.
And I want to remind our listeners, the book is called White Nationalism and the Republican Party Towards Minority Rule in America by John Ehrenberg, our guest. John, you write that the Reagan administration, quote, set the conditions for the most dramatic upward distribution of wealth in modern history, end quote. From 1980, when Ronald Reagan was elected, until 2016, when Trump was elected, the income of the 1% drastically increased, while the income of the bottom half markedly decreased. How did the Republicans manage that huge transfer of wealth and income from the bottom to the top?
Yeah, it's a great question. Any conservative party that competes in open electoral conditions like the Republican Party has a very serious problem that it has to solve. The problem is that its economic program is a program of the very wealthy and the corporations, but its political base is the lower middle class and the more privileged elements of the working class. Somehow it has to square that circle. And that really is what race has enabled the Republican Party to do. And the Republican Party has, in fact, built an electoral coalition based upon the white petty bourgeoisie and elements of the white working class around an economic program that benefits corporations and the rich. The trade-off is that the economic program of the Republican Party for the last 50 years has consisted of three legs. The first and most important to them is deregulation and dismantling the web of economic regulations that constrain what corporations and the wealthy can do. The second element of it is privatization, and the third element is tax cuts. And so those policies that every single Republican administration has pursued ever since 1965 have channeled wealth upward to the detriment of the white working class and the lower middle class. So the big question is, well, what do they get out of it if they're being fleeced and robbed by Republican economic policies? What do they get out of it? And what they get out of it is a psychological and ideological conviction that the Republican Party stands with them and is going to protect them against black crime or immigration or whatever particular elements figure in this or that Republican candidate's platform. So the trade-off is an ideological and emotional and psychological boost to exactly those elements of the population who are being fleeced by the upward distribution of wealth. And it works. It's been working for half a century, and it's still working now. It is what led directly to the election of every single Republican president since Barry Goldwater's 1964 candidacy against Lyndon Johnson, and it continues to be the dominant element in the Republican Party's coalition.
So these Trump supporters are actually voting against their own interests when it comes right down to it.
They are, but they aren't. I mean, it's a complicated matter. They're voting for a president who is going to preside over economic policies, and Trump certainly did, who's going to preside over economic policies that are going to take money from their pockets and from their children's futures and hand it over to corporations and the rich. But they get out of it the ideological and psychological conviction that the president is on their side and is going to defend white privilege and white racial animus against real or perceived threats. And that's a real material element in the Republican Party's coalition. So, you know, it's a kind of a shibboleth on the American left that these people are deluded and that they're voting, like you said, Margie, they're voting against their interests. Well, they are on some level, but on another level, white people get paid every single day for being white. And Trump recognized that and promised millions and millions of aggrieved white voters that he would protect their very real and very material interests.
Right. Maintain that white skin privilege. You write that, quote, the extraordinary thing about the spike in racially tinged politics is that it happened in the absence of dramatic changes in the objective conditions, unquote. How did the GOP go from, in your words, quote, a party of fiscal restraint, free markets, and limited government, to a party of nationalism, xenophobia, immigration restriction, overt racism, misogyny, and existential resentment, unquote?
Yes, that's quite a mouthful. I mean, I'm surprised I wrote that big, long sentence. But it's true. Look, racial animus is always latent and present in the American white population. It's always there. It can be fanned into a flame and can be called up as an active political force with incredible ease. All you have to do is, the Republican Party has become an expert at doing this. So even in conditions of relative racial peace, this is the extraordinary thing about it. I mean, it's one thing to say that, all right, the civil rights movement spurred millions of American white people to declare that they had it with social disruption and racial demonstrations and all that. An alleged crime wave, you know, was enough to convince white voters during Reagan's runs for president that he would defend their property and their children from attacks from crazed racial minorities. But the last few years have witnessed a period when racial politics were simmering at best on the back burner, and yet Trump was able to fan it into a flame. It only goes to show just how powerful this force is in American political history, and people on the left know this and have yet to figure out a way around it.
For those of our listeners who've just tuned in, we're speaking with retired political science professor John Ehrenberg about his new book, White Nationalism and the Republican Party Toward Minority Rule in America. John, Donald Trump mobilized what you call, quote, the old demons of U.S. racism and xenophobia during his campaign. Trump's appeal to white supremacy, built on strategies used by Barry Goldwater, George Wallace, Richard Nixon, Reagan, and the Tea Party. How did Trump weaponize the use of race and turn the Republican Party into a political instrument of a perceived threatened racial order? How is Trump's use of racism different from that of his Republican predecessors?
Yeah, that's a good question, and that really is the question that sits at the heart of the book. Because the Republican Party has emerged and developed from being a conventionally racially conservative party into a party that is increasingly prepared to actively flirt. I think that's the best way of putting it, to actively flirt with white nationalism. Up until Trump, Republican presidential candidates and Republican presidents ran as racial conservatives. That is, they pledged that they would do no more to advance racial justice and racial equality than the law required them to do, in many cases, as with Reagan, for example, they decided not to enforce certain aspects of racial legislation, but they didn't go so far as to suggest turning the clock back and dismantling some of the legal and political gains of the civil rights movement. That's where Trump is different. Trump was more than simply a racial conservative. Trump really honestly promised and attempted in many, many cases, and in some cases did so successfully, to dismantle many of the legal and political protections that the civil rights movement had won. So the inflection point, if you want, is that up until Trump, you're dealing with a traditionally conservative racial political party. From Trump on, you're dealing with a party which is actively preparing to organize permanent white minority rule.
Trump's slogan is "Make America Great Again." What does that mean, and where does it come from, and how did the election of Barack Obama feed this racism?
Well, Trump got it from Reagan. "Make America Great Again" was a Reagan slogan. What it means, I mean, God knows what it means with Donald Trump, but I think the best way of describing what it probably means to him, again, is this is a decidedly reactionary proposal. Trump's whole shtick was the claim that the United States has lost its way, that it's being misled by a political leadership which is alternately incompetent and corrupt, and as he famously put it, only he can fix it. The "it" that needs to be fixed is an America that's in industrial and political and moral decline. This is an old claim on the part of the right, but Trump was able to feed on the very real material grievances of a beleaguered white population, and he was able to weaponize it by racializing it. And he was able to racialize it by pointing at immigrants, and then, as I say, and as you point out, summoning the old demon of racial animus that is always resident in the white population. So, again, you know, Trump, in some respects, is a more radical version of what came before. You know, Richard Nixon ran as a candidate of a beleaguered, resentful, white, lower middle class. Ronald Reagan, his political base was the same. But with Trump, as with racial matters, Trump was able to seize on the very real deindustrialization and economic devastation in the American, particularly in the American Midwest, and ride it to victory.
John, you write that Trump voters made more money than Clinton or Sanders supporters. Why do you think those who support Trump are more unified around race than class?
That's the question. That is the question of American politics that nobody on the left has been able to figure out. Bernie came close, but, you know, we don't know. I mean, no progressive or leftist political program in this country can succeed based solely and exclusively upon the old categories of class. That is clear. Trump made that clear. But, you know, what happens in American politics is that issues of class get expressed in terms of race. So the racialization, if you want, of American politics is a class issue at bottom. But the language and the ideological categories in which it's discussed are the language and the ideological categories of race. So this combination, and you know, the United States stands alone in Western societies in the racialization of its political discourse. Solving that problem and figuring out how to talk about issues of class without ignoring the enormous importance of race has been and will be the most central question facing the American left.
I'm tempted to ask you, John, what is your proposal for solving that question?
I don't have one. I mean, I really don't know the question, I don't know the answer. I mean, if we had a credible, organized, leftist political party with a real honest-to-goodness program that it was putting forward, then we would have a framework within which to discuss this, and we might be a lot closer to coming up with a politically viable solution to it. But since we don't have an organized political leftist party that puts forward a credible political program, we're all at sea. I'm at sea along with everybody else. I can't answer your question, Michael. I wish I could.
I think what you said is absolutely true. And we don't have that kind of leadership, that kind of party, that kind of program that can help us, at least not yet. I wanted to just remind our listeners that we're speaking with retired political science professor John Ehrenberg, who has just had published a very fine book called White Nationalism and the Republican Party Toward Minority Rule in America. I'm speaking with John, as is my co-host, Marjorie Cohn. John, as a white minority party, why do the Republicans have to be anti-democratic? You write that holding power against the wishes of the majority requires authoritarianism. Were you talking here about fascism?
I think the Republican Party is becoming a quasi-fascist apparatus. This is a unique political formation among all the political parties of the West, with the exception, perhaps, of Hungary, which these people profess their admiration for. But the Republican Party is uniquely dismissive of science, dismissive of democracy, willing to engage in racializing politics, pandering to the worst instincts of the electorate. Trump, in this sense, is just a symbol. I mean, he didn't do this all by himself. Trump was responding to the enormous anger and sense of dispossession of tens of millions of alienated white voters. I think what happened is an interplay between Trump and a lower middle class and working class base. That is always, by the way, the base of fascism. Fascism is always rooted in the petty bourgeoisie and the more privileged elements of the working class. That's its electoral and political base. Even as it serves, as we've said, as it serves the interests of corporations and the wealthy. So what you're witnessing with the Republican Party now is that this is now a thoroughly abnormal political formation. It is very, very different from conservative parties anywhere else in the advanced democratic countries of the world.
John, you say that plutocracy dominates U.S. politics and the economy. What is plutocracy and how does it differ from fascism? What is the relationship between capitalism and fascism, and how does fascism factor into your analysis?
As we said before, I mean, the Republican Party is moving in the direction of becoming a mass-based semi-fascist organization. Plutocracy is the descriptor, which, you know, really comes from the Greeks, of the extreme concentration of wealth at the top end of society. It is synonymous with political corruption and political decay. And if you read, you know, the ancient Greeks, you read Aristotle, and particularly Aristotle, but also Plato, they warn about oligarchy and plutocracy, and they warn about the political corruption and disease that comes with the concentration of wealth. There's nothing particularly inherent in concentrating wealth that leads to fascism, except that fascism in conditions of political crisis does become the political expression of an oligarchic or plutocratic political system. And I think that's what you're witnessing here. And that's what Trump represented. Trump is the spokesman for extreme populist-based politics in an era of ideological and social and economic crisis. Does that mean fascism? That does set the stage for what I think we characteristically call fascism. George Dimitrov, the great theorist of the Third International, defined fascism as the terroristic rule of the most backward elements of monopoly capital. That's a pretty big formulation, but I do think that that's the direction that the Republican Party is heading in. It's openly contemptuous of democracy. It is actively trying to undermine democracy everywhere it can, precisely because, as you say, Margie, its demographic base is shrinking. Lindsey Graham famously said a few years ago that there aren't enough angry white male voters to support the Republican Party in the years ahead. The more minoritarian the Republican Party becomes, the more aggressive its attacks on what remains of bourgeois political democracy. And that's what you're seeing now, all the way from restrictions on voting to increased use of surveillance powers to harass political opponents. And, you know, there's a whole laundry list of measures that they're undertaking. But they all tend in one direction. As the Republican Party's demographic base shrinks, its commitment to permanent minority rule has to get more violent and has to get more anti-democratic, and it will.
John Ehrenberg, your book ends by saying that the, quote, racially reactionary plutocratic party faces a future that will surely be an unkind one. What's the source of your optimism?
Probably stupidity, but in the short run, I do believe in some sense that the demographics are going to solve this problem. There's really very little way in which the Republican Party, even with its immigration restrictions and its attacks on citizenship and the various methods that it has already devised and will come up with in the future, I don't think the Republican Party can hold back the demographic changes that are transforming the country. This is becoming a much more cosmopolitan and much more international electorate than it ever has been before, and sooner or later, this wave, and they know it. I mean, the important leaders of the Republican Party, from Lindsey Graham to Josh Hawley, they all know this, that time is not on their side. So, you know, I do tend to be an optimist by nature. I hope that demographics trump, so to speak, contemporary Republican politics. But like you say, Michael, we're just going to have to wait and see.
John, I hope you're right. How can our listeners follow your work?
Well, the book is out. I think that's the best way of doing it. The book is published by Routledge. It's available on Amazon as a hard copy, an obscenely expensive hard copy, but paper and an e-book as well. So, you know, that's a good place to start. I mean, you know, the book, I think the book is basically correct in its analysis and its projections. But, you know, it remains to be seen if other people will feel the same way.
We've been speaking with John Ehrenberg, retired political science professor, on his new book, White Nationalism and the Republican Party Towards Minority Rule in America. John, thank you so much for being our guest on Law and Disorder.
My pleasure, Michael. Great to see you.
Thanks so much, John. We'll have you back soon.
Thank you, Margie.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Despite the clear language of our Constitution that Congress shall have no religious test for the office of judge, every Republican in the Senate except one put Amy Comey Barrett on an already packed right-wing Supreme Court. Barrett is a leader of the charismatic Christian cult called People of Promise. It's a group that Protestant and Catholic evangelicals formed, and they reportedly speak in tongues, they believe in the subjugation of women, they oppose their right to choose and control their own bodies, they oppose gay marriage, and are authoritarian and pro-corporate in the extreme. Garrett earned her bones by first clerking for the now-dead Justice Antonin Scalia. She was part of the legal team, along with John Roberts, who helped Republican George W. Bush steal the presidency by stopping the recount of ballots in Florida in the year 2000. The Federalist Society, led by Leonard Leo, has been responsible for packing the federal courts with over 200 largely unqualified young ideologues who will serve for life. Leo, like the 6 of 9 Supreme Court justices, is an ultra-right-wing Catholic. For 20 years, he has guided the Federalist Society. He is a member of Opus Dei, Latin for God's work. It was founded in 1928 by a Spanish priest who was also a lawyer and a supporter of the Spanish fascist dictator Francisco Franco. Ultra-right-wing billionaire Charles Koch and the Bradley Foundation have contributed to the efforts of the Federalist Society. Dark money is behind the appointments of now over 200 judges in the federal judiciary. Organizations funded by dark money fund and encourage plaintiffs to bring cases challenging laws they don't like and write the briefs to submit to the judges they help put on the bench. We speak today with attorney Lisa Graves. She created True North Research and is its executive director and editor-in-chief. Her research and analysis has been cited by every major newspaper in the country. Attorney Graves has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the government. She served as chief counsel for the nominations for the U.S. Judiciary Committee under Senator Patrick Leahy. She was a career deputy assistant attorney general at the U.S. Department of Justice. Graves has spent the past 10 years investigating the impact of dark money on the judicial selection. Lisa Graves, a real pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's a joy to be on with you.
Lisa, 2 weeks ago at the Amy Comey Barrett confirmation hearings in the Senate, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island called the hearings, quote, a puppet show. He said the strings were being pulled by dark money, that the objective was to remake the national judiciary, diminish the civil jury, weaken the regulatory agencies which protect the public trust, allow unlimited money in politics, and restrict voting rights. Please talk about his testimony. Talk about dark money. What is it and who has it?
Well, I think what Senator Whitehouse did this past month in describing what's happening to our Supreme Court and the dark money swirling around it is of vital public importance. And that's because what we have here is a situation where a very powerful man named Leonard Leo, who is the co-chair of the Federalist Society, which describes itself as a group of conservative and libertarian lawyers and law students, actually has been playing a key role in packing U.S. courts, federal courts, the Supreme Court, and other courts. Leonard Leo is the person who chooses the judges that Trump chooses from, and he's choosing people to advance an agenda that he himself described at a closed-door meeting that the Washington Post revealed last year. At that closed-door meeting to funders, Leonard Leo said that America stands at the precipice, at the edge of what he described as the revival of what he called the structural constitution, the likes of which no one had seen since before the New Deal. And he basically described how no one in that room that he was speaking to was alive to see the kind of legal revolution that was underway due to these appointments. That effort to basically roll back a century of law that the right wing in this country dislikes is an unprecedented sort of extreme effort to re-engineer America in their own image. And they're doing it with dark money. Dark money in the electoral context is money that is not disclosed because it's not given directly to a candidate. It's money that is spent to help that candidate win. And this Supreme Court under Roberts has already begun that structural revolution that Leonard spoke of. And that's because in the Citizens United decision, it said that Congress could not regulate and limit that outside spending by those groups if they didn't, you know, go directly to the candidate call for that candidate's election. It said in the Shelby County case on voting rights that basically the Voting Rights Act of 1965 could be gutted based on that narrow majority on that court. And also it said in the recent redistricting cases that other courts could not intervene even where there was gross, extreme partisan redistricting that was denying fair representation to Americans in terms of who represents them in Congress. And so this revolution is underway, and we don't know who the major funders are. We know they're people who can write million-dollar checks to influence who gets on the U.S. Supreme Court and help push them through despite their controversy. We do know that Charles Koch, who's one of the richest billionaires, in the whole wide world, is very invested in trying to capture our courts to accomplish his extreme agenda. But we don't know who all the funders are who are having such a disproportionate impact on who gets chosen for the court and how they get pushed through. We also know, as Senator Whitehouse pointed out, that many of the groups that are getting money from those same interests are also bringing cases to the Supreme Court to get those decisions that they dislike overturned.
Lisa, now that Barrett is on the Supreme Court, the reactionaries have a majority. How will this affect upcoming cases like the legality of Obamacare, gay marriage, and the right of a woman to control her own body?
Well, I think those cases are in grave jeopardy, and that's because Leonard Leo was choosing judges to meet the litmus test that the president, President Trump, and his party have said that they're going to impose on this court, and that includes trying to choose judges who are going to overturn the Affordable Care Act, who are going to overturn Roe versus Wade. That's their agenda. It's explicit. We know that gay rights are also at stake or at issue here. That's because this reactionary majority that's been chosen has hostility to the rights of LGBTQ Americans. And we know from a decision just this past week where Justice Thomas and Justice Alito issued an opinion basically in the case involving the clerk that refused to issue the marriage license, that they're trying to use freedom of worship not as a shield, but as a sword to strike down the rights of other Americans, and in particular, the rights of LGBTQ Americans. But also, we know that this president has said that he wants and he wanted Justice Barrett on the court. He wanted her on the court because he wants her vote in election cases that are going to be coming to the court that are on their way right now, in which he's going to be trying to stop votes from being counted by Americans in order to win this election by judicial fiat. And so a huge number of rights are at risk, but also other rights, as those that were alluded to in the Leonard Leo speech about this legal revolution to roll back a whole century of precedents around the laws that were passed in the New Deal.
I'm thinking about the Janus case, and before that, Citizens United, and the Shelby County case that you mentioned. Might you please speak about these?
Yes, it's certainly the case that the right wing in this country has targeted labor rights, has targeted a number of statutes and judicial decisions to try to reverse the rights of Americans to organize and to negotiate all the terms of their working conditions with powerful corporations. What you have in many ways in these past several years is the sort of supremacy of corporate rights over individual rights. You can see that in the Hobby Lobby case. In that case, there was a retailer, a craft store, that claimed that the company had religious beliefs that would bar it from allowing its employees, the clerks, the women who work for those at that retailer, from having access to IUDs, which is a common birth control device. And so that company's corporate sort of, quote, religious beliefs were elevated over the actual rights of human beings, the women who work there, and their rights to access affordable health care, including birth control. Meanwhile, after that decision was issued, that company was found to have stolen 11,000 artifacts from the Middle East. And so apparently the thou shalt not steal religious dictate didn't apply to them, but they were going to impose this view by a corporation about women's access to birth control as a religious belief. That's not all. We've seen that in the Citizens United case, where the right of a corporation, a nonprofit or for-profit corporation, to quote speech, meaning spending money, was elevated over our rights to have laws that protect against corruption in our democracy. And that supremacy of this corporate right to spend money as speech has taken place in a period in which we've seen tremendous crackdowns on actual human beings speaking out in protest and dissent over pipelines, over racial injustice in this country, and other issues. And so this court really has embraced a notion of corporate supremacy that is totally dissonant and inconsistent with the core principles and rights actually protected for human beings in our Constitution.
Lisa, tell us more about Leonard Leo, Federalist Society leader. the society is responsible for selecting judges that the Republican Senate goes on to confirm. Over 200 federal judges have recently been put in place in the lower, appellate, and Supreme Court, as we've seen. Tell us a bit more about Leo's agenda and his connections to the reactionary right wing.
Yes, you know, it is the case that the Federal Society has been given a privileged role in judicial selection in Republican administrations, and no more privileged role than this current one, where Leonard Leo, who is now the co-chair of the Federal Society and previously its executive vice president, where he has been tasked by Trump with actually choosing the slate of judges that he picks from for the U.S. Supreme Court, for the highest court in the land. But we also know that almost all of the appellate judges, meaning the circuit court judges who sit between the trial court judges and the Supreme Court, most of those, if not all of them that Trump has picked, are from the Federal Society, are members or active participants in Federal Society events. And that society, you know, really is funded by unknown sources. Its biggest known donor is Donors Trust and Donors Capital, which are two funds that hide their donors. Another big donor is a big right-wing foundation. And of course, Charles Koch is a major multi-million dollar donor over the years to the Federal Society. But Leonard Leo himself is someone who went to Cornell Law School. He ended up going to work for the Federal Society basically very early in his career, having joined it initially. And he has gotten very rich, it appears, from his work on judicial nominations. And I say that because he's claimed that he has been a volunteer for the president, so he doesn't fill out any financial disclosure forms that an employee of the federal government who's tasked with helping to choose judges would fill out. And I myself was at the Justice Department working on judicial nominations, and I know that all the lawyers in the White House Counsel's Office and the Justice Department who work on nominations go through a background check and have financial checks. But Leonard Leo, as a, quote, volunteer, does not reveal the sources of his income or his growth in assets. And we know that in 2018, the year that he was working to get Brett Kavanaugh installed in the court, he took basically a $100,000 pay cut from the Federal Society, but he paid off the mortgage on his home, a 30-year mortgage he paid off about 22 years early. And on the eve of the vote on Kavanaugh, the day that the Senate voted on cloture to move forward with his nomination, Leonard Leo closed on a $3.3 million mansion in Maine. So he has enriched himself while he's been playing this role, and no one knows who's making him richer because those sources are hidden from the American people. They're not required to be disclosed under current law. Subsequently, this year, he left his paid position in the Federal Society to be the co-chair of it overall, and created, with some of these colleagues who've been working on these dark money groups with him, a new group, a for-profit group, to advance this agenda.
Lisa, do you want to say anything more about the Federalist Society and their agenda and who funds it, or have we covered that sufficiently?
Well, I would say that it's quite clear that the Federal Society is funded by major corporations. A lot of the lawyers who are part of it work at law firms in defense of huge corporations. A number of the attorneys that are part of it are part of the GOP's efforts on election law, including a number of these lawsuits to make it harder for Americans to vote and to try to limit the ability of Americans to vote during this pandemic, in terms of extensions that some states have tried to provide so people can vote. A lot of lawyers who work for huge corporations, as well as one of the biggest corporations on the planet, which is Koch Industries, which is led by Charles Koch. And its agenda really has been to change American law and change it in ways that advance those corporate interests, and in my view, really limit the rights of ordinary Americans. And in terms of Leonard Leo's role, it has also included this attack on core rights of women in this country, reproductive rights, as well as equality rights. And so I think that Leonard Leo's role in the judicial appointment process is very troubling, especially because he appears to have gotten very rich while doing this.
Lisa, you mentioned Charles Koch. Please talk about the efforts of his group, Americans for Prosperity.
Sure. Well, Americans for Prosperity is the political arm of Charles Koch. And Charles Koch has operated under a number of groups that have changed their names over the years. But recently, there was a memo that went out to his billionaire funders, his allies, in these efforts, in which he talked expressly about working with the Federal Society on judicial nominations and on other issues. And just to be clear, I'm not suggesting that Leonard Leo is engaged in illegal activity. I think there are substantial gaps in the law that have been exploited that have allowed this person to play such a decisive role without having any meaningful disclosure to the American people. But Charles Koch is one of the main proponents of that attack on our election laws, on anti-corruption laws. And in fact, earlier this year, I documented how his money helped subsidize the original decision in Buckley versus Vallejo in terms of the litigation in that case back in 1976, which is the root of the Citizens United decision and this effort to limit our ability to take action to limit the influence of dark money forces like Charles Koch, basically, on our elections. But the agenda of AFP is quite broad and I think has been very damaging for America. For example, it was Americans for Prosperity in its predecessor name, Citizens for a Sound Economy, that really first pushed forward in a big way the effort to repeal Glass-Steagall, which was the protection that was passed after the Great Depression, after the meltdown of Wall Street back in 1929, to prevent banks from engaging in the kind of gambling that wrecked our economy in 2008. It was America's Prosperity that really, in its predecessor form, Citizens for a Sound Economy, that helped work on efforts to attack Kyoto and the initial efforts 30 years ago to try to stem the tide of climate change that was underway. It played a key role in trying to push forward this narrative of denial and uncertainty around climate change. It has engaged in an array of activity to make it harder to regulate corporations like Koch Industries and pollution, but it also partnered with the tobacco industry on trying to limit the impact or the reach of regulations around tobacco, which causes cancer and kills people. Its record is one of trying to take away from the federal government's power of taxation and state governments as well to tax in order to have a government that functions well for the American people. And so in the states, it plays a very a heavy political role through its C4 operation in the states and elections. And in fact, even though Charles Koch has attempted to distance himself from Trump the man, Charles Koch and his operations have worked quite well and closely with Trump the administration to dismantle regulations that protect Americans' rights to cleaner air and cleaner water, as well as the Consumer Financial Protection Board, as well as this ongoing effort to attack and erode the Affordable Care Act. But not just that, back in 2016, Americans for Prosperity played a key role in swing states in moving voters out and toward Trump in terms of buoying Trump's efforts in 2016, even though Charles Koch himself did not endorse Trump.
We're speaking with Lisa Graves, the great investigator. Lisa, this information is really quite extraordinary. Both of us are from Wisconsin, and as a consequence, I've always taken an interest in the Bradley Foundation, which is centered in Wisconsin. Can you talk about the Bradley Foundation and the role that it plays?
The Bradley Foundation is a fascinating case study in one of the things that has happened with wealth and influence in America. This is a foundation that was created from the wealth of two brothers who had an industrial, endeavor, series of factories in essence in Milwaukee, and that got very, very rich. They were extremely hostile to labor rights and to, progressive ideas in America. And they created a foundation back more than 50 years ago to put their wealth into this sort of tax-protected philanthropy, or put a portion of their wealth in it. It now has more than $750 million in assets, so it's nearly a $1 billion enterprise. And while they are long gone and their family members are no longer on the board of the Bradley Foundation is led by two other billionaires, by Art Pope, who has worked long with Charles Koch and David Koch previously at Americans for Prosperity in advancing that agenda, and Diane Hendricks, who's one of the biggest donors to the Republican Party alongside Art Pope here in Wisconsin. And they help steer the money of that foundation to advance this right-wing agenda in America to really remake the United States. That includes efforts to push these charter schools and efforts that take money out of public schools and put it into basically private hands, which is a longstanding part of the right-wing effort of Charles Koch and Milton Friedman to limit public schools, to take away the idea of public schools and put more of that money into private hands and private education, education that may not actually include information that people need to know to be really well-informed citizens, but rather push a particularly narrow ideological agenda. But the Bradley Foundation has also played a role behind the scenes, as Senator Whitehouse spoke about this past month, which is that they've been funding amicus briefs, which are briefs, so-called friend of the court briefs, that are written to the U.S. Supreme Court to try to influence them on rulings. And that includes on cases involving the Affordable Care Act and also on labor cases. So the predecessor to the Janus case you mentioned is a case that this foundation was funding through a group called the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which also is funded by Charles Koch, to attack both labor rights and Americans' rights to access affordable health care. And so it plays, I think, a very significant role in funding the right-wing infrastructure. And as Bill Cohen just covered in Vanity Fair this week, it has had a significant relationship with a number of the writers of the Wall Street Journal's editorial board, including giving some of them what's called the Bradley Prize, which is a $250,000 gift for their supposed excellence in advancing that agenda.
Lisa, in January of this year, Leonard Leo started a new group called CRC Advisors. What do you know about it?
Well, we know that it is this group is tied to one of his best friends, in essence, this guy named Greg Mueller, who was running CRC, which was previously known as Creative Response Concepts. That's an advertising media firm that, you know, has been active in a lot of campaigns, including getting money from Charles Koch's groups like Americans for Prosperity to advance its agenda. This group is working with a number of other sort of shell groups or front groups that are tied to some of the same individuals that have been working with Leo on this court capture. And that includes Neil Corkery and Ann Corkery, who were previously the leaders of the Wellspring Committee. Wellspring Committee was a group that was basically a pass-through for the money of some of these big donors in order to influence policy and courts in this country. It would receive, for instance, a check from an unknown source for like $24 million and then give almost all that money to another group tied to Leonard Leo called the Judicial Crisis Network, which is the group that was has been most active in advertising for these Trump judicial appointees to the Supreme Court. But it's also tied to other for-profit and nonprofit groups that are also tied to Leonard Leo, that Leonard Leo has a ownership interest in. And so it's quite the nest of, or what I think of as almost like a shell game, of LLCs and nonprofits that are all working to influence who gets on our courts for lifetime positions, and who is really funding them is kept hidden from the American people.
Nancy McLean and Jane Mayer have written about the influence of dark money on the selection of state legislatures and governors and judges, and in drafting and promoting laws that favor the rich. They demonstrate that this has been part of a many decades project. Your thoughts about that, please.
Well, I think Nancy's precisely right on that point. And her book, Democracy in Chains, is really an important read. What she described is how this notion of what I call free market fundamentalism has really taken hold within the current Republican Party, which has been in many ways taken over by the sort of Koch libertarian theories. What that means is when you see these groups, they'll say things like, with respect to Amy Coney Barrett or the Federal Society, that they favor limited constitutional government. In terms of other groups like the American Legislative Exchange Council or Americans for Prosperity, these other two Koch-funded groups, they call it limited government. And that's really a clever way of saying limited democracy, limited democracy is their objective, which is why Nancy's book, Democracy in Chains, is such an accurate description of what they have been doing in the United States and abroad. And that's this effort to basically enshrine this sort of free market notion that the free market knows best and that government should not be engaged in the public good, that we shouldn't have things like Social Security, we shouldn't have public schools, we shouldn't have the public really do anything besides protect property. That's a very radical reactionary view of government. And it really stems from one of the key influencers on Charles Koch's life, which was this guy named Bob Lefevre, who ran a thing called the Freedom School that was described as a, quote, anarcho-capitalist school. It was basically just a school in Colorado, outside of Colorado Springs, where millionaires and right-wingers would come to learn about this philosophy. Bob Lefevre refused to call himself an anarchist. He described himself as an autarchist as a way to around that term. But in essence, the idea was that government really has no place in society, in what they view as in everything it does impinging the rights of corporations and individuals, except for the protection of private property through police. That is just a view of America that is not consistent with our actual constitution, with our founding principles, and with modern modern interpretations of our rights through the Civil Rights Act and others that sought to give meaning and effect to principles in our constitution like equal protection of the law. And so we certainly have a right to have laws that protect against discrimination under the 14th Amendment. We certainly have a right to have laws that Congress can pass and that agencies can promulgate through regulation to protect our rights to clean air and clean water, our rights as citizens to regulate that through our legislature.
Lisa Graves, we're unfortunately coming to an end of our allotted time. I just want to say personally that it's just a joy to speak with you. Both of us are products of the state of Wisconsin, the great state of Wisconsin, and the educational system that we went through there, which posited the idea that government and universities should work for the public good. With that in mind, I wanted to ask you what you're working on now, and how can our listeners keep in touch with you and keep in touch with your work?
Oh, well, thank you so much, Michael. I am a proud graduate of the University of Wisconsin at La Crosse. I believe it's vitally important that Americans have access to quality education that is affordable if it's not free. People can find me at truenorthresearch.org and Koch Docs, that's D-O-C-S, kochdocs.org. And I'm happy to come on anytime and talk with you and Heidi. It's a joy to be on your show.
Thank you so much, Lisa Graves.
Thank you. Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.